David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise episode 468. I'm your host, Steve Raker. Down in the comic book bunker, surrounded by a library of Marvel's publishing history, and my co-hosts, Andrew the LA Rabbit and WWX Worldwind Kevin. Yes, we're still using our old bullpen bulletins, Marvel Noise, Munden's Bar, message board monikers, but that's where
that's
we all
back,
met.
Steve. That's going to come back. Anyway.
We all met, was it like 07, 08 back then on the board? So be it.
That was a good time.
Marvel Noise is the podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. And in the spirit of Derek Coward's Deliberate Noise Network, on Marvel Noise, we talk about all things Marvel. Whatever catches our eye or burns our britches, whether it be comics, movies, television, toys, games, or fandom at large. You can find, listen to, and download episodes over on marvelnoise.com and get new episode announcements on our social media pages. What else we got? We got Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show at indiecomicbooknoise.com, which is up and running again, too, thanks to the benevolence and hard work of Andrew the LA Rabbit here.
And Kevin.
Way to chip in, Kevin.
And the handing off from Derek. Hopefully we'll have our iTunes issues straightened out, but the website is up and running.
Yay! We've got Marvel Comics and Marvel Studios news to discuss.
Before
we get to that, one of my son's teammates and good friends on his travel club lacrosse team, his name is Merrick, number 13, a long stick defensive midfielder like my son is. And Merrick said he gave our podcast here a listen. So we better be on our best behavior, number one. And number two, I asked Merrick what his favorite characters are, and Spider-Man was the first that came out of his mouth. And demonstrating some comics cred and wisdom, Merrick added anything amazing, spectacular, and added that the current series really isn't capturing his interest, which is basically mirroring our opinions here.
And it seems like the comic buying public in general.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, I've heard some boosters of part of the run, kind of like the run had some people that were just like really into certain aspects. And I was like, I don't see it.
My advice is start calling it Absolute Spider-Man and hope somebody.
There's a big milestone issue coming up, issue 1000, right? They got to do something good there.
If you say so.
But when I mentioned to Merrick the upcoming horror-themed Spider-Man title, the Midnight Spider-Man that's coming out this fall, he dropped a Kraven's Last Hunt reference on me. So he's read some Spidey books. And then today, Jack, my son, has his friend Aiden over. He's showing him the bunker. And bam, he's into Spider-Man 2. When I say Spider-Man 2, I mean Spider-Man also. Inside joke. With that in mind, I thought it would be fun, because we don't really talk a lot of Spider-Man around here. If an issue catches our eye here or there, we talk about things. But, you know, Spider-Man's one of those titles where it has a consistency to it over the decades, over the years that we habituate to. And unless there's a real big high or a big low, I think we just sort of follow along in Spidey's life. And it's kind of a neutral book in my mind.
Yeah, I feel like we do a lot of the Spider-Man universe or spin-off stuff more than we do the main title proper.
Yep. Yeah, when that Cardiac Marvel Legends dropped, I don't think we could stop Kevin from talking
about it
for love or money.
So with that all in mind, I thought it'd be fun if we could like share a few favorite Spider-Man comics as recommendations for both Merrick and Aiden. Maybe they've read some already, or maybe a few will catch their interest. And everything we bring up, I'm pretty sure, is going to be on the Marvel Unlimited app, which, if you don't have, guys, is a great deal. You get access to decades of Marvel's publishing history as digital comics for something like, I don't know, $7 or $8 a month if you pay annually. And I think there's a free trial month option, too. There used to be, at least. But also many, if not all, these comics have been collected in hardcover Marvel Masterworks, in Marvel Omnibuses, and in softcover square-bound Epic Collection reprints, too.
And not to put on my Homer hat too much, but I'm in the cheapest level of DC, and I feel like they do not, they seem to shift it around or whatever. They're really missing. Obviously they have so many more books, but a lot of times I'll do searches for stuff and just come up empty or close to empty, and it's pretty frustrating. And not real obscure things too, but I feel like the Marvel Unlimited, it really is a lot of stuff. There are certain eras. I know in the 90s it can kind of be a little spotty at times, but it really is a pretty, it's come a long way, baby. Because I remember when I first started, I actually quit. I thought it was so bad they'd have 2 issues out of a 4-issue limited series or something. But if you're thinking back to those days, try it again. It really has. They keep uploading stuff. Almost always, if they're putting out an omnibus or an epic, they're going to be loading those into the system. The only questionable ones are obviously the ones that have license issues, or they're cross-licensing something, Conan's or whatever. Those can be a little bit dicey sometimes.
What about Max? What about that Phoenix Max series from X-Men? Is that on there?
Well, like I said, some of the 90s. Well, wait, that was 2000s, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that era of, I don't want to call it the dark period, but it was my personal dark period of,
wow,
I kind of kicked out. Well, I didn't have no money, so wasn't reading no comics. And
Punisher
those.
Max stuff on the Unlimited, don't they?
Sure? Maybe.
I'm pretty sure they Max, do. Yeah.
The Phoenix thing is just kind of infamous. So,
Let's get this round table of favorite Spider-Man comics for Aiden and Merrick started here. I actually went with issues all from the Amazing Spider-Man title.
And same.
I'm going to hit them chronologically, because that's how I roll, except for my bonus or possibly bogus pick that I'm saving for the end. And guys, I can't endorse the picks of Andrew or Kevin here.
Holy cow.
They might get silly with this.
We
might end up getting like the rhino sitting under a tree sniffing flowers in a field or something like that. You never
know. That was so good.
See what I'm saying? All right. Give me a good Spider-Man
book. Unseen endorse Steve's and Kevin's picks. There, I'm saying it. I don't know what they're going to say. I'm endorsing it.
All right, why don't I get it started then, since I'm on a roll already here. Starting off early in the Amazing Spider-Man title, I've got Amazing Spider-Man number 15 from 1964, written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko. It's from the, original Villain of the Month era of Spider-Man, and it's the first appearance of Kraven the Hunter. Given the significance of Kraven's last hunt, it's kind of cool to see how his grudge against Spidey starts. And it's a darn good little one-issue adventure. Kraven's presented as a great hunter who gets hired by the Chameleon, another Spider-Man bad guy, to take down Spider-Man. And Kraven treats it like he's hunting an animal. And like, the Chameleon's disguise ability comes into play, too. But it's just fun old Stan Lee, Steve Ditko era Spider-Man. And it's also interesting because they mention Mary Jane for the first time in this issue, even though Peter wouldn't meet Mary Jane until issue 41.
You hit the jackpot, Tiger.
Yeah. Yeah, you hit the jackpot when Kraven starts getting those lasers shooting from his nipples. I mean, it's good stuff then.
But this is like, Kraven's going to drug his prey and like weaken him and like, track him and draw him out. And he's using all these hunter techniques, and it's fun because he's not a known quantity yet.
All right. Guess what I have? Something from February 1966.
Rhino sitting under a tree.
What?
The rhino under the tree. Whatever Steve said earlier.
I'm not stealing Phil's picks.
Give me the year again.
February 1966.
All right.
So, yeah, Amazing Spider-Man 33. The most Spider-Man comic of all time. Maybe one of the most Marvel Comics comic of all time. The final chapter.
I would have this held off. I would not have this be your first Spider-Man book. No, but no, go on,
Steve convinced me I should go in chronological order.
Okay.
These guys have read Spider-Man before, too, based on my interaction with them. So this isn't going to be their first Spider-Man comic.
Okay. So, yeah, this isn't that final chapter. If you know, you know. This is the final chapter! Exclamation point. So this is, your Ditko Lee joint here. But, yeah. One of the greatest covers, Spider-Man's under a large piece of machinery, water's coming down, and, he has to do that thing he always does. And this is the first time he did it.
It's the end of the Master Planner, saga, right?
It's yeah,
gonna
exactly.
get homaged yeah. for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
That homage will live past me.
I mean, even though it's like in a thousand things, I mean, it is still, there's a reason. Like, this is the original exactly. story, and it's just a great story. I mean, some people can complain, oh, you can strip Stan Lee's dialogue out, whatever. Like, it all works perfectly.
True that.
Oh, eat your wheat cakes, son. All right. obviously, I'm going to say, as a preface, the only Spider-Man run you need is 1 through 38 with the first two annuals. I mean, that's Steve Ditko built Spider-Man.
I mean, that's a run.
He built everything you think you know about Spider-Man. What's interesting, well, I probably wouldn't suggest just dropping down and reading them. We've covered AF-15. Back then, they weren't doing a lot of research ahead of time. They kind of built these guys on the fly. So I feel like it takes till 2 or 3 when they really start vibing. I mean, 3 is first Doc Ock. Then I think they're really in their stride. The early issues are also, he's kind of like the science hero. So it's a lot of Peter using the science, not just for his marvelous outfit and weapons, but beating the bad guy through his brains, yep. which is kind of a fun way to look at it. I would say if you want a blast for some, to get a feel for the vibe, 8 is the Living Brain debut, which has a bit of the high school dynamics and also kind of the silliness of it all. Or if you want something a little bit heavier, but still in that fun vein, 10 is the Enforcers, which is just some great designs and some goofy characters and sort of starting to introduce the street crime element, because before it's kind of like Freak of the Week for Spider-Man. I mean, ignoring his debut, it's all these science mutants gone wrong and he's got to figure it out. The 11 and 12 are a nice Doc Ock Spider-Man fails and has to overcome, which will be another long-standing, and he's kind of a, I don't know, also establishing Peter Parker as a loser, but he doesn't give up. These are sort of key elements that run and why I like those. If you are going to do the final chapter, you really need to grab the two before it so you get the full thing. Also, it's the Master Planner, which we're going to see. We saw already with the Big Man when the Enforcers, they like have, and we'll see with the Green Goblin, the sort of mystery villain. How can you figure it out? The other one in that early run, I mean, I'll be honest, 38's not great. That's the last sort of filler one he did. And I would also say I really always love 28. It's the Molten Man debut, and it's a dark cover, and it has that sort of sadness to it that Spider-Man's not only infects Spider-Man, but his cast has a sadness. There isn't a lot of joy, and it's really this people that have tragedy in their lives. And that's also reflected in the first. You'll see JJJ, for all his bluster, has a lot of sadness in him, past the anger. And I think those layers are shown in those issues. Plus that black cover in there, it's the sadness of Betty Bryant and how that ended up working out. So those early issues really build this world that will be reflected again and again with different creatives. Obviously, annual one, Sinister Six are born. I mean, how many Sinister whatevers do you have? Again, not a one to start with, but such a fun layout. The old school, if you like, pinups and things like that, just doing the annual. And we must have talked about this, Steve. The annual two is Ditko pairing his two greatest creations, Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. I mean, all we need is Mr. A to show up, and it would be the greatest comic ever. And that one's just fun seeing him put those two characters together. Probably annual one is of more importance, but that is the Ditko Spider-Man laying all these layers. And that's why if you take one of any of the issues we've suggested and you like it, then you can go through the whole run on the Unlimited.
Yeah, that's why.
And get the feel. But I wouldn't have you start with AF. Yeah, you don't need, but if you like it and you see those things being built and you're like, oh, this is fun, then you can be like, oh, maybe I will try. You know, you can, I mean, we all love Sucker Finger Beetle. He shows up in 21. I mean, not created in this series, but such a fun one. The Spider Slayers get debuted in a silly way. Yeah, just fun, humor, tragedy. It's all laid out in these early issues. And for me, I had reprints, and they just really hooked my brain as a youngster.
I'm going to, for my next recommendation, jump up to 1970, the year I was born, with Amazing Spider-Man 88, 89, and 90, known as The Death of Captain Stacy. Arc.
Yeah.
And Spidey's fighting Doc Ock, and it's a three-issue arc. It's written by Stan Lee. It's got pencils by John Romita Sr. on the first issue, 88, and then Romita Sr. inks over Gil Kane's pencils on 89 and 90, which are really clean, good-looking book. I mean, it looks like the Spider-Man that you see in any promotional material for a Spider-Man toy or anything like that. It's just so clean, and the images that were licensed, literally. And this era can be a little bogged down by the Peter Parker side of things, but it's a great classic Spidey Doc Ock confrontation with some really cool action sequences. First, you've got Spidey fighting Doc Ock's arms that are on their way across town to break Doc Ock out of prison, which is fun all on its own. Then you've got Doc Ock hijacking a plane and forcing it to land, and Spidey's got to like infiltrate it and face Doc Ock there. But best of all, you've got a couple of really grand rooftop battles between Spider-Man and Doc Ock, where, you know, the chimneys are getting crushed and the rubble's falling down on the bystanders below. It's all that good stuff, and these sequences from these issues are what inspired those scenes from the Spider-Man movie with the Doc Ock. They did a whole building side, building top battle that really mirrored some of this stuff. Plus, there's the whole meaningful death of Captain Stacy at the end and a big revelation at the same time that hits home to Peter Parker under Spidey's mask. But good stuff from 1970 in Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, 88, 89, and 90.
Back when the good guys smoked pipes, kids.
Yeah. If they were old.
Yeah. Always picture Captain Stacy with the pipe in his mouth.
That would have killed him if...
Wow.
If this issue didn't.
Well, I'm moving forward to January 1987.
Wow.
Yeah. Because if you know anything about me and reading Spider-Man, I love a good gang war.
All right.
So, yeah, like, you show me this cover, there's Hobgoblin, Hammerhead, Jack-O-Lantern, Rose. I mean, I can't open that comic fast enough and see what's happening.
What issue number is it?
What is the story? 284 to... It's a six-parter.
Wow.
So it's 284 to... or five-parter, sorry. To 288. So, it has the Kingpin. It has that crazy Punisher cover where he has, like, a rocket launcher on his on his shoulder. Spider-Man's in his black costume. You also have that cover where, like, Spidey's fighting the Hobgoblin. And, like, there's a police officer pointing a gun at the Rose. You have that crazy cover where, like, Spider-Man is just yelling at Daredevil, telling him to stay down. If I have to go through you to stop the Kingpin, I will. And you're like, what is happening?
Wait, what was that issue number again, Kevin?
284 to 288.
Yeah. Oh,
so good. Yeah, I was thinking, I love 253, the first rows. It's a great cover. Yeah.
And then you have the conclusion with the Kingpin, and then the Black Cat is there, Falcon is there. I mean, when I was digging through those back issues to get those issues from the 80s, I'm like, I was all over stuff like this. I was just like, oh, yeah, just give me more of that. Inject that right into my veins.
I'm going to have to reread those issues because I'm not that familiar with them, because that was the period while I wasn't reading comics while I was in high school in the beginning of undergrad. So I did go back and get them as back issues and probably read them once while they were in a pile that I kind of breezed through, you know.
And the description is great. It says there's a bloodbath on the streets. There's Silvermane. There's the Ranger. I'm like, yes, yes.
Jesus, got all the gangs.
I know. I love that stuff to this day.
That's awesome.
All right. Another one I only experienced in the wonderful world of reprints, but before he was star of a best-selling movie, soon to be movie series, Michael Morbius haunted the pages of Spider-Man in the early days, those 101, 102 ones where he and Spider-Man has the six arms.
Yeah.
Gil Kane. Like that's, it was mostly through the, like I said, reprints. I had the giant, I think that was in the Treasury.
It was. That's how I had it too.
Oh, so good. Such a great Marvel kind of dancing around. Can't have vampires. Well, let's have a science-based vampire.
A living
that made it
vampire.
So good. And the classic Gil Kane upshot with the hatching on the nose that I love so much.
It is.
Yeah, just
awesome.
Thumbs up all the way around. It'll also give you a feel of the best of that era. And if you're like, you know, this is some good stuff, then you can keep going. Like maybe you hang out for Dead Gwen Stacy and all that stuff too. And Kangaroo and Punisher and Doc Ock and Aunt May getting married in 131. You know, it'll give you a feel for some of the best of that time. And then you'll be like, yeah, I'm going to stick with this for a little bit. Or you're like, that was fun, but let's spread our gaze to other books too.
I had those issues on my short list too.
Marvel Tales.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because they were doing those reprints, and then I was just like, oh, I want to check out some classic stuff. And yeah, I was still weirded out and everything by that story, going, what? So, good stuff.
For sure. I've got, speaking of the annuals that you mentioned before, Andrew, I was thinking about that annual number two, but when I, because I do love when the Ditko creations are combined, they really work well together, and Spider-Man and Doctor Strange really work well together as they have over the years, across different creators handling them, so much so they made it a movie, right, of having the two of them bouncing off each other. It's fun to see your regular guy Spider-Man, who is in way over his head if he's dealing with magic, trying to get from point A to point B with magic stuff going on around him, or trying to bounce around a changing landscape that doesn't make sense, or just, you know, not mess up a spell, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but plus the kind of serious Doctor Strange against the always joking Spider-Man, it's a good team up.
So I went with a books that we've actually talked before about last year on episode 450 of Marvel Noise from March 2025. So I won't go too deep into depth here, but it's Amazing Spider-Man Annuals 14 and 15. And why I combine them is because it's the same creative team on both of those annuals. It's writer Denny O'Neill and artist Frank Miller. And the two of them worked together on Daredevil, where O'Neill was Frank Miller's editor on Daredevil. And they have a pretty good handle on the Spider-Verse, the supporting characters and what makes Spider-Man Spider-Man, and them, while during their epic legendary Daredevil run, stepping over into the Spider-Verse to do these two annuals, really turned out a couple of good comics. The first was in 1980, annual 14, and it's Doctor Strange, Dormammu, and Doctor Doom. Miller's take on Ditko's designs are great, whether it's like the magic, Doctor Strange doing the spells or shooting the blasts, or the dark dimension. Miller obviously is tickled by Ditko's designs and really has a great take on them. Basic deal is Doctor Doom sends like a low-level mage lackey of his into the dark dimension to get powered up by Dormammu, and he turns into this like combination of science and magic type of villain, and sends a big like magic robot thing after Doctor Strange, capturing him. And while Doctor Strange is captured, he sends out like a mental summons to Spider-Man to come save him. So Spider-Man's gotta figure out where to go, what to do, and how to do it. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, there's these little yellow sticky headless demon things that their strength is in numbers as they try to overwhelm you, that come after Spider-Man, and they're so silly and so fun, and I imagine that someday they evolve into like Pixar minions. The second book is 1981, the annual 15, and this is The Punisher and Doc Ock. And this one's just as much of a Punisher story as Spider-Man, but the Punisher at this time was a Spider-Man supporting character, villain. He was a Spider character. Daredevil too, but more so here. And when he was in Daredevil, it was O'Neill and Miller handling him, so here they are bringing that stuff here. The horizontal panel sequences that Frank Miller comes back to two or three times this issue to show Doc Ock's arms extending and affecting their prey is just so cool. It works every time he uses it, including at the end where his arms are going through these different rollers of a printing press of the Daily Bugle to like reach the spot where Spider-Man's hanging or hiding. Just really cool stuff. And there's a classic scene of the Punisher meeting the rookie cop at the end. And the Punisher goes to jail, which took the Punisher off the board in real time when I was reading comics as at this time, 81, as like an 11-year-old. It took the Punisher off the board for 2 years. He would break out of prison in Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, number 81 in 1983. And actually, it's really funny, Kevin, he has Boomerang help him escape, like the two of them escape together. And when they get to the wall and they're climbing over the wall, right when they get to the top of the wall, the Punisher kicks Boomerang back into the prison, you know, field and takes off. And Boomerang's like, you jerk.
Yeah, what a guy.
Two great issues.
Well, I'm going to take us screaming into the 90s, I guess.
Do it.
July 1990. I've probably brought this up before. I mean, at least I brought up Doc Ock's cocaine rocket. I mean, Dr. Octopus is showing up a lot on this list, isn't he?
Oh, he's as far as I'm concerned, Spidey's number one. I know a lot of people like the Green Goblin, but for me, Doc Ock's the top of the food chain.
Yeah, Green Goblin is more like, I mean, I guess if the original was stuck around, I mean, he was more like a haunting legacy type of. I mean, Harry has some good goblin stories, but anyhow,
there's lots of great stories, but for the iconic, I would probably say there's more iconic of Doc Ock. There's so many great Doc Ock stories.
Yeah.
Anyways, what issue numbers are we looking at roughly?
Oh, we got 334. To what is this? 339. So this is a six-parter, and I believe it was a bi-weekly, wasn't it? Like early, early, late. They would write on the cover because I think it was during the summer.
Yeah, so the summer when they want to really ruin what little money, extra money.
No, here, kids, buy twice as many comics. Yeah, so. It's crazy to think that this Sinister Six started in the 60s, and like for 30 years, no one ever brought them back.
Yeah, I almost picked these issues too, Kevin.
Yeah. So yeah, you have Michelinie and Larson on the book, and it's just, I mean, it's just fun 90s comics where you have all those guys together again, and of course they have to make membership alterations because Kraven's not around. But yeah, there's a lot of development too with the supporting cast and all their planning, and it's just fun to see all those villains. And then if you were following it, like I wasn't following it week to week, but I mean close enough, I guess. It's some of the first back issues that I could find. I'm funny enough, on part six, it also says the final chapter again. No, also not the final chapter I was referring to in my other final chapter joke.
Well, I'm going to piggyback on Steve and do it in a cowardly way, like I always do, by having multiple. But the Marvel annual tradition, Spider-Man has a really strong set. Annuals are a super mixed bag. They go from like reprint material to like exciting. I'm sure we've covered Atlantis Attacks and other goofy, well, cross-wide issues, but Spider-Man has some really great ones. Personally, I've always responded to 16, which was the Monica Rambeau Captain Marvel debut. I really like that one. But I mean, you can just grab the 2020 Iron Man, Arno Stark is in 20.
Oh, yeah.
21 is The Wedding, which is great, sort of reminiscent of the Fantastic Four getting married. And then we've talked about 22 is the debut of Speedball. In our new Warriors segment, we talked about that crossover one. What was that? 26. So just a really strong. Probably if I had to pick any of those, I would probably grab the Wedding issue just for its prominence. Spider-Man started off strongly age advancing and made it through high school fairly quickly, even made it through college, and then it sort of stalled for a little while. But they did develop the relationship with Mary Jane. Then it culminates in the marriage, and then years after that it lasts. Not going to really talk about the unwinding of that. Did not make my list of recommended
Right.
Spider-Man comics.
And stories to skip
when the writer takes his name off the book.
And it just felt like there was a real nice momentum carried through that. Now, I understand the fear is that, well, then you retire him and then you end up with the M2, which was really exciting. I really loved May Parker, who became the next Spider-Girl in that alternative universe books that they did, which was a real fun series. I think we've talked about that too, where they're like the
Yeah.
next generation of Marvel in its own separate continuity. Real fun stuff, great issues there. So, yeah, any of those annuals, you will not be disappointed. I feel like, I mean, yeah, there's a few stinkers, but man, there's some not great, awesome annuals in a lot of the Marvel canon. I mean, I actually have the omnibus for Atlantis Attacks or whatever, but I can't really recommend you read all those things. You know what I mean?
Funny
Well,
when
you
you're
can
going
see the
through.
Gwen Stacy clone.
Yeah. Oy. It's funny though when you're looking at how many different characters appeared in the Spider-Man books, and not just like another villain or whatever, but a lot of heroes they kind of launched through Spider-Man, and it's just because Spider-Man works so well off of other characters.
Oh, yeah.
Because and that's why they gave him the team up book, the Marvel team up book for however many years that was, 150 issues or whatever. Spider-Man works great off of another character. So, in these annuals, many times they used another character for him to bounce off of, whether it was this Captain Marvel or, like you said, some of these other characters that popped up there. And
Speedball.
yeah, Speedball and even the Punisher issue one that I was talking about, issue 15 of the annuals. But it's wild. Spider-Man works with everybody. I've got from 1982, Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, I should say, 229 and 230, written by Roger Stern with art by John Romita Jr. and Jim Mooney inks. This is Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut. A nice, basically straightforward idea conceptually. Kind of like a video game, straight line. Someone's getting from point A to point B can you stop him? It's your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man trying to stop an unstoppable force. Mm. He had just recently met Spider-Man, that is, and befriended this being, individual called Madame Web, who is an elderly, feeble, blind woman who is attached to this life support chair web assembly thing. And her deal is that she can see visions of the future. And the X-Men villain, the Juggernaut, is out to get her because his partner wants to use her precognitive skills against the X-Men. And so she calls out to Spider-Man for help. And he tries and tries and keeps trying. You know, good old Spidey, he keeps trying. He feels the responsibility and he's doing everything he can and then some. It's a fun couple of issues, and there's a reason why these are considered classics.
I thought of putting some stories like that.
Hard not to.
So this is where things get a little muddy, but I'm not going to be like Andrew. So,
all right, good.
I'm gonna mention something, but then I'm gonna say, but.
Uh-oh.
But yeah.
Look, if you want to put Brand New Day on your list, Kevin, you go ahead. No one's stopping. I'm just saying, even though I co-signed ahead of time,
just
that
Bob
one
Gale.
I do regret.
Just the Bob Gale issues.
No. Yeah. So I am fast forwarding us into 2010 for the Gauntlet story, but really you should just go all the way back to 546 and just start with Brand New Day. I mean, as stupid as as they are to say you can't write any stories when he's married, I mean, that idea is absurd. But I mean, this is a good starting point for someone. Like, I remember being in a bookstore and someone saying, well, have they written any good stories after Kraven's last hunt? And then the owner's like, no, there's been no good stories since then. And I'm like, what that guy was really asking for was Brand New Day. Like, if you're a bookstore owner, you should be putting that book into that guy's hands. Anyhow, I thought it was a missed opportunity. I always think of that. But yeah, like, one story, it's kind of serious, The Gauntlet. And I know some people were like, oh, that should have went on forever. But I don't want a serious Spider-Man story to go on forever. Like, a story is a story. It takes however long it takes. But eventually you're going to get to something else. There'll be some other goofy story where he's, like, fighting Boomerang or something. But yeah,
it's always great.
But yeah, like, Spidey gets exhausted during this run. He goes through, like, a lot of his good rogues gallery here, and then you get some pretty crazy moments. Like, I don't know if that lizard story that happens in here where he does the thing is necessarily part of the Gauntlet or just like an interlude in the Gauntlet, but it's pretty much like a Gauntlet story, and it is crazy the amount of good stories, serious stories, like the art in here. It's pretty wild. Like, it's a great run, The Gauntlet.
So we should say, too, what Brand New Day was after the editorial decided that Spider-Man shouldn't be married anymore because there's a cap, a ceiling on the stories that you can tell when he's married. He can't have romantic angst or whatever, like, as if married couples don't, you know, whatever. Kicker. So
it's weird, too, because they're like, we can't write stories. Oh, so we're going to write all these great stories that have nothing that you could still write when he was married,
right,
to prove
right.
that you can't write these stories. So I'm like, whatever, guys.
So they ended Spider-Man's marriage in, what was it called? Like, One More Day or something like that. It was like four issues. And then the era that came after that, they called sweepingly Brand New Day. And what was different about it was, instead of having one writer and one artist working on the book, they had what they called the Brain Trust. And they had like four or five writers who were alternating arcs. And they had four or five artists alternating things too. So there was a lot of different stories being told. There wasn't a sense of like, this is just what the book looks like and what it reads like. There are, like you said, there was a lizard story in there with the Chris Bacalo art. That's crazy. There's a lot of different stuff in here. And because of that, some of it is easy to look over because there are some gems in there.
Yeah. It's also interesting that before Brand New Day, it was all decompressed. His supporting cast was like two characters. Like there wasn't subplots and everything. Basically, I'm like, there, like it was pretty straightforward and not a lot of substance. And then after this, it's like, whoa, now you have to follow like five storylines. There's subplots. There's a lot of characters, new characters like Screwball and Mr. Negative. Like it's such a change.
All right. I'm still, man, I got about a million. I'm never going to finish my list. I want to, as I've talked about before, certain covers stood out. I love the black covers, even though they look like crap now. So Amazing Spider-Man 188 is burned into my brain. It's Jigsaw being chased by Spider-Man with the, and I remember it being the creepiest issue ever.
Yep.
Not sure it's going to hold up. I don't know if I'm going to, I have revisited it, but I'm so hopelessly in the tank for it. It would be impossible. You know what I mean? I can't judge that issue. I love that cover. Spider-Man's form, they do black and red, and he just blends into the background. He kind of drives Jigsaw crazy. Yep. Really, just for me as a kid, that was tremendous. That whole era, then 189, I think, was at my dentist's office. And it's, spoiler alert for JJ's kid as the man wolf god creature and everything. All that stuff. But then it leads to another black cover, is 194, which is the first Black Cat, which again, that cover, I have two copies of it. Like it was just such a distinct, again, using the kind of black to blend, but there they put some shadow around her to give her a bit more form. Such a great, and she ends up being such a kind of key character in Spider-Man's life that I feel like it's worth it, even if it turns out you're like, you know, Andy, that wasn't that good, or there are better Black Cat stories, obviously.
Yeah.
But just on a cover basis and issues that stood out to me, some of this is about what grabbed you when you were a kid,
yep,
or when you're reading Spider-Man. And some of these aren't, you know, don't age or whatever, but this is getting into Andy's like prime. Oh my gosh, the Spider-Man really is. Like, I always liked it. You know, he was on The Electric Company, which is a show for kids, and I had the reprint. But this is, like, kind of getting into starting to be my Spider-Man.
Yeah, I almost picked 194 and 5, too, just with the first appearance of the Black Cat, just because Spider-Man hadn't ever faced an opponent who was being playful with him, right? There was a flirtatiousness among the fighting, and she was kind of one step ahead of him, and it was more of a trying to chase someone than fight them.
Yes.
I thought that was a fun dynamic, and obviously so did everyone else, because she ended up developing into a pretty important supporting character.
And a fun arc with her getting powers and being more into Spider-Man than Peter Parker, and then just a really key part of the Spider universe. And debuted with, like I said, I'm a sucker for those black covers. I think it's because, Steve, they age so poorly.
Right? You see your fingerprints on them. All right, Kevin, my second to last one here, my last real pick, and then I just got my bonus one to add in, is Amazing Spider-Man 577 and 578 from 2008, Kevin.
Oh.
It's written by Mark Waid with art by Marcos Martín. And this is called Unscheduled Stop, these two issues. And it's he basically is fighting the Shocker, which is an old character from the old Villain of the Month era in those first 30 issues that Andrew was talking about earlier. But he's represented here as like a serious villain, which is really great. And Martín's art is so simple and colored so beautifully, and the way he lays the book out, it's just one of the most pleasing couple of issues of Spider-Man I've read since the Steve Ditko era. And the idea is that Peter's on a subway train and the Shocker attacks it because he's trying to kill a juror that's on some jury for his mob boss, against his mob boss or whatever. But the subway tunnel collapses, the train, the lights are off, and Peter's got to change into Spider-Man and help passengers escape from this collapsed tunnel and fight off the Shocker. The art is just so wonderful. And there ends up being a character amongst the passengers who is related to a supporting character in Spider-Man's supporting cast, which gives him an extra personal stake in what's happening. And it's just really cool. Great New York Spider-Man story, reminiscent of the book that Kevin talked about of Spider-Man lifting all the rubble from over his and machinery from up top, but this time he's underground and dealing with it. And a good couple of books. Do you remember those, Kevin?
Oh, yeah. I have a certain reaction to those books because of a book I picked, too.
Let's go.
This is going to be a Marcos Martin love fest here.
So be it. What do you got?
So after you finish the gauntlet and Brand New Day, it evolves into Big Time. And you should just read all of Big Time. Like, there's no brain trust anymore. Dan Slott comes on, does a great long run. But I don't want to pick a whole run because this isn't about runs. So one story I had to pick is that nobody dies. No one dies.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
So that's a pretty, I don't know if I would say famous, but I think it sticks out if people are looking at this entire era where that's what Spider-Man proclaims. And not really spoilers, but a lot of people have died under his watch or something's happened to them. So there's stuff going on in his status quo at this time. And, he makes that decision. And then there's also a sequence in here where Marcos Martin has to draw all these different characters. So it's really nice.
About what issues are these?
Oh, yeah. 655. And 656.
Nice.
And 656 has this crazy spider armor number 2, I guess. Is it number 2, the second spider armor? Or is this another? It's a spider armor anyways.
Kevin just going to keep taking shots at me, which is fine. But we've launched books before and after it. But for me... It's going to be 238, the debut of the Hobgoblin, which was a great character, and it felt like they were making, now I get my own Green Goblin. Not that I didn't always like the Green Goblin, but, he's obviously from well before my time and all the Gwen Stacy business and all that, but the Hobgoblin's my jam, and it's also we don't know the identity of this Spider-Man villain, and it's going to wear a few different hats, and just... obviously you can do that for, the handful of issues till you get to that reveal. But I would say keep going. 248's the big classic. That's the Kid Who Collects Spider-Man, which has been adapted in a few different ways and is a classic one-off if you want to feel a little sad and have a bit of a tearjerker.
Yeah.
That's a great issue, I think. But this whole thing, if you can... I don't know, just run right, like 252 ends up with the first black suit. It's a great run. I can see if you're like, Andy, we got enough of this era. It's not my jam. That's fine. But I think if you start in there, you'll get a feel for the vibes of how they're going. And like Kevin talked about, we're getting some of the crime boss, gang wars, all that stuff. It's just a fun. And then that's going to capstone right into Kraven's Last Hunt. And then I would tell listeners right after Kraven's Last Hunt, that's when Todd, Uncle the Todd father jumps on. with a 298, and he's only on there for a couple years. But you want to know what? My advice to you is just flip through, and whatever cover grabs you, read that issue. Spider-Man's always attracted great artists, but I will say McFarlane really brought a dynamic sense of composition to the page, the pages and the panels, and he always was trying to make everything a little more extreme and exciting, and it was just a nice, right at the time for me, it was an incredible breath of fresh air. For me, I associate him probably most with Spider-Man, but Hulk and Batman are right up there for characters, because I wasn't really on the Spawn train for our indie comic book noise listeners. But I would say look through and just whatever issue grabs you're like, yeah, and then just sort of vibe out to it. Or for Kevin, it's probably Larson who followed him, you know, that kind of exciting dynamic following that tradition that they're going to take over to Image. But sometimes, you know, you just got to let a cover guide you.
Yeah. I mean, I came in on Larson, but I was also trying to get those McFarlane issues at the same time. And the funniest thing is, like, maybe people left or went to Image and then Bagley came on. I was just like, yeah, now Bagley's my guy. So I mean, is just one big thing
exactly.
for me.
Yeah, yeah. And Bagley, the same thing. Long run, great artist. You know, you can get the hologram 365. What, like I said, the beautiful thing about these issues is if you just look through and be like, oh, that's exciting, that's part of that era of comics is being sucked in.
Connective tissue of that whole era that you're describing, the Todster and Larson and Bagley, it's writer David Michelinie.
Yeah.
He had a big, long, successful run on the book that
He's a good writer.
All right.
I really wanted to include the Hobgoblin because when I quickly wrote down a bunch of things I wanted to talk about, but there's like the Hobgoblin story is just like you get an issue. There's some other stuff. Like there's good issues in between, but it's not like there's one story or anything you can direct someone to read. It's like you got to put together all these Hobgoblin stories through the years.
I was just thinking,
so I'm
of
like, I can't really talk about it as, oh, read the Hobgoblin saga, because there isn't.
Well, there was that original saga of those first three two-issue arcs that kind of ended with 250. When the first Hobgoblin, with the Spider-Man fist coming up out of the water with the Hobgoblin's mask, when the Hobgoblin was finally defeated for good, and then he would pop up again, and then they would change who he was and get into all that craziness. But at the beginning, at least, it was a great concept because the Green Goblin was one of Spider-Man's main bad guys for so many issues until he died. Then they tried to come up with ways to bring the Green Goblin back a couple of times by having his son be mentally ill and become the Green Goblin. And then there was another Green Goblin, but it wasn't Harry. And who the heck was it? It was Harry's psychiatrist who learned the secrets through Harry. And then he became a secret. But after that, there was no Goblin for, you know, like 70 issues or so, you know, many years. Yeah. We're talking 6 or 7 years. And so there was a Goblin vacuum in Spider-Man's rogues gallery. And to have the way they first presented it was like some burglar guy breaks into a room that he doesn't realize what's in there. And oh my gosh, it's one of the Green Goblin safe houses that has all the Green Goblin's equipment. And he starts modifying it and becomes a new Goblin character, and Spider-Man's like, who the heck is this guy? And it brought back the Goblin fun that had been gone from the book for so long.
Yeah, and it's not like one of those modern things where they're just like, oh, we're gonna have a Red Goblin this month, and Goblin and that Goblin. Like, this seems like well thought out.
Oh, yeah, because you couldn't bring back Norman, right?
Yeah.
You couldn't bring back the Goblin, even though they did in the 2000s, but back then you couldn't do that, and so they came up with a creative way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very creative. And
they just take the easy way out. We'll just bring back Norman. You're like, oh, man.
Yeah.
For good or ill, you know. But here's my sleeper pick. There are highs and lows, and it's a whole big, long run by a writer. And this is J. Michael Straczynski's run on Spider-Man. He was a television sci-fi writer. He had a show that was kind of like a popular syndicated show, Babylon 5, that he wrote for. And what he did with Spider-Man in the second volume of Amazing Spider-Man, the 1999 beginning run, in issues 30 to 58, And then it resumed the numbering of the original title with issue 500 and went on from 500. And he wrote the book for 70 issues, so there's a lot of stuff there. But what he did that was interesting, and I don't know if I would be as excited about it if I was a kid reading it, but reading it as an older person, like both Aiden and Merrick are, to be able to, they're more mature readers and can handle something a little different or a little dark. The angle that Straczynski added to the Spider-Man mythos was this whole thing with this Ezekiel character, who was this mysterious, super rich guy who knows something about Peter and Spider-Man that Spider-Man doesn't know or understand. And it's this whole spider totem lore that he adds onto the book that, on the surface, it's silly. But it was cool to have something more mythological added to the... Like he said to Peter, when the radioactive spider bit you and died, was it, like, did the radiation kill the spider after it bit you, or was it because of the radiation on the spider that made you Spider-Man? Like, there's this whole, like, threads of destiny and all this other stuff. And the mirror to the piece of the lore of, like, there's parts of you that you don't understand and you're part of something bigger here, is he adds these unstoppable foes. One of them, name was Morlun. And they're these characters that, like, eat totem characters. So Spider-Man's basically got this, like, juggernaut class character that he's not just trying to stop from getting to A to B. He's trying to stop from killing him. He's coming after Spider-Man, and he's going to destroy him. And there's really nothing Peter can do about it. Or can he, if he learns the right things from this wise old Obi-Wan Kenobi type guy, this Ezekiel? So it's more adult, it's darker, there's high stakes, there's a lot of anguish. There's an arc called The Other, and then there's a Back in Black thing when he gets back into the black suit, that it's not Venom this time and he just wants to kick some ass, and Black reflects his mood better at this point. Ezekiel is like a mystical, shamanistic type. It's just adding these different elements that I found interesting. It's also the last of the married Peter Parker era, because his run ended with the ending of the Mary Jane wedding, and the writer divorced himself and refused to kind of write the story, and editorial took over and did the deed. But Michael J. Straczynski's run is an interesting one if you're in the right mood for something a little more or a little different.
I have a fondness for it, Steve, because I had gotten Costco sold those amazing Spider-Man scan discs, and it ended right before that. So I had to hunt those down as back issues. and it was really fun, and I kind of enjoyed hunting them down and getting back into Spider-Man in a way. And it was, you know, right around then after that was Civil War, and it just felt like comics were sort of back in a strong, like, seemed like everywhere in pop culture. That I think Civil War even made the news and stuff a little bit, like, ooh, what are the geeks reading type of thing. So I'll always be fond of that stuff. And I feel like it opened the door to the modern multiverse Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I mean, Spider-Man's always had that, but that was like the gateway drug to get you into the multiverse, which of course has found success in the cartoons and all that
and
other
the artwork
stuff.
During that era is great too. I mean, Mike Diodato did a run on there where it, again, things look a little more dark and adult just because of the way that he does his moody art. Romita Jr. does stuff, and it's the introduction of J. Scott Campbell doing covers at Marvel at all, working for Marvel at all by starting on these books doing covers for Spider-Man at the beginning of Straczynski's run with issue 30. All right, any others, or should we jump into Spider News? All right, give me another.
I got my last round. Okay, my last is going to be a quick hits for you, because I didn't go crazy, but I do want to discuss a few other simple Spider-Mans. I want to shout out For the web series, the one I would think about is the four-part Missing in Action, which is 17, know, up through there. That's Mark Silvestri, which is kind of fun. I don't think of him, you know, I think of him as like Wolverine and X-Men and all that. So it's fun to see him taking on Spider-Man, and it's Michelini again, and it's, you know, a bit before Last Hunt and all that. So that'll give you the time frame. But Webb was supposedly like the edgier of them. I don't know how that jived up, but despite what regular Marvel noise listeners are going to be confused and think Marvel Team Up was a Human Torch book, but it actually is a Spider-Man book. And for me as a kid, Marvel Team Up 15, again, I only had it in the reprint form in the large treasury, but that's the Ghost Rider one, which has the orb and has that gruesome close-up of the orb outside of his mask, which is horrific as a young kid. I mean, now it's not even... It's probably G-rated.
Andrew, it was
or
so
whatever.
Big. That panel was so big in the Treasury edition. When you did the page flip, it was like, ah!
Yeah, scared the bejesus out of me. Now, what's nice about the team-up is they're mostly like little two- and three-parters. So if there's any character you like and want to go be like, oh, how do they interact with Spider-Man? They always interact well. But you get Captain Britain coming over to America in 65. That's a real fun one with that, his goofy old outfit, which was terrible. I'm sure we must have talked about the Living Monolith ones, which are like, Havoc and that's 69 and 70, because I know Steve is a big fan of all those issues. And then the classic Saturday Night Live issue is 74. That one might not be on the Unlimited for the licensing reason, along with 79, which is the Red Sonja one. So some of these ones will be fun if you feel like back issue hunting for silly. Again, remember the context of when these are going to be late 70s, kind of irreverent, super condensed, sort of just having fun with it. So don't, you know, go crazy with it and expect this to be the sort of same thing. It had a feel for it. Not that they wouldn't try things, but I've enjoyed some of my another favorite super minor villain, not Pace Pop Pete, but the White Rabbit. Because she debuts, I believe, with Frogman. Isn't that her first? Which is 131. Yeah. So, and then right before then was the Vision ones. 129 and 130, which is a nice two-parter, that Vision and Scarlet Witch, which we may have talked about. But again, fun if you want silliness. There's like the Aunt May and Galactus assistant editors month. I don't know. I just think Marvel Team Up is fun and it's low stakes, so you can just read an issue or two on the Unlimited. And last is the other flagship title was Spectacular. Super quick, 64 is your first Cloak and Dagger. Steve said they're great debut characters. Now, their continuity gets a little crazy, but I still think they worked well. Because for me, Spectacular seemed kind of the grittier title in a way.
It's where the Gang Wars were happening. Yeah.
Yeah. And then another fun one. Well, I shouldn't say fun, but 73, the four-parter, that has the Deb Whitman, which was a crazy Peter Parker love interest. That I recommend people, because she doesn't always make the lists anymore, but what a kooky character she was, and just lots of fun. Personally, if you have to only read one issue in the entire series, 86 is Fred Hembeck. So, you know, assistant editor's month.
Crazy.
I love me Fred Hembeck. Those curly Q knees, Steve. You got to love it. And then on obviously a more serious note, the other heavy one when I was a kid was the death of Gene DeWolf. That was like, you know, kind of before Kraven, that was the serious. Gene DeWolf had been a very minor but consistent player in the Spider-Man universe. And but it felt like a real character. Like sometimes they introduce these ones and bump them off and you're like, yeah, I could see that coming from.
Because when I left in 85, at the beginning of 85, I had heard of Jean DeWolf a couple of times, but she wasn't much of anything. I almost feel like they built her up to kill her off, because yes, all that happened after.
But if you're reading it, when I was reading it, it felt like they were taking a real character and bumping her off and making it kind of, that made it feel like serious stakes, because Spider-Man, as we've talked about, you know, it can be sad, but it was generally goofy or funny or whatever. So that death of Jean DeWolf saga, again, maybe it didn't age well or whatever, but at the time, I can recommend. And then the other thing is, one of the all-time great, and we've talked about him, Spider-Man artists is Sal. And he had a long run. And we've talked about like 200 or whatever, but I always, that's another one where if you just want to flip through and see what part of it you want to go, but he was underrated in my lifetime. I don't know, maybe people talk more about him before or after, but I always thought he was underrated, but just to put in that kind of time for an important character for so long on a big title and do so great at it. Like, I know we as comic book heads like Sal, but I feel like he was not, you know, the superstar artist, let's say. But what a great, magnificent long run. So maybe you want to take in the 200 and build up, or just flip through and see what you like. But let's recognize Sal's long role in being a Spider-Man artist, you know. Not on the Ditko level as the creator, but
one of my favorites, actually. There are some books that he was involved in that were good, but when I flipped through looking for some through that era, it was because I do like J.M. DeMatteis's writing, and he wrote the title for quite some time with Sal's art, but it was hard for me to find a favorite Spider-Man story in there.
Well, it's hard because 200 is kind of out of the, I mean, we talked about it on issue
with the hologram on the cover.
But it's hard to, with the whole, you know, hard to,
Look,
that was that was maybe a possible, I don't know. That's why I was like, kind of flip through and see, take it in, see how you feel about Sal. But it's a long run, man, in an era, especially nowadays, where those sort of runs are, I mean, Ditko's is 38 regular issues and 2 annuals, you know. And the same, Todd's was roughly about the same. So it's kind of shocking, these huge artists that had enormous impacts, but maybe not the longest runs.
Any last hits, Kevin, before we get to some news? Close out the episode?
I don't know. Maybe you want to read some Spider-Man tangent stuff, not just Peter Parker Spider-Man.
Well, in that case, Merrick had said to me that his first Spider-Man was Superior Spider-Man.
Oh,
and he really enjoyed that series.
Yeah,
so
yeah. So I would say, if you wanted to get off the beaten path a little bit, maybe the path is still fairly well beaten at this point, but still, it's not Peter Parker. So like the original Spider-Man 2099 is a good place to go. The original Spider-Gwen series, another good place. Or if
like
you want to. Or if you want to read some flashbacky tales, we covered the whole series on Marvel Noise too. Untold Tales of Spider-Man. That's a nice, going in between the raindrops of the original Ditko issues and everything.
Yep.
And we've talked about Superior Foes as well, if you want to have fun.
Yeah, that too.
We beat the hell out of that, but that was a great, fun, tangential to Spider-Man, but if you like humor in your books, give it a try.
All right. That's a pretty thorough list of recommendations to fire off and find something that you like. Talk about beating something to death. We beat that list.
10 minutes or so.
Once we get in. some Marvel Noise news and notes and whatever is, one thing just quick to get out of the way. I read the Marvel Zero #1 that came out this week. It seems like every year, every other year, they come out with another Zero issue that kind of sets up the next year and supposed to get you excited, but for giving you sort of little previews or tastes of a few different series and everything. And almost everything fell flat in this issue to me. except for maybe the Infernal Hulk stuff that my friend Philip Kennedy Johnson is writing. A lot of it was really not that great. But
I didn't even know there was a Zero this year.
I didn't
see
it. Yeah. Bad Andy.
Also, I finished the Spider-Noir Disney Plus show, the one
Oh,
with
me.
Nick Cage.
No, that's on Amazon here in the
Oh,
United
Amazon.
States.
Amazon. All right, that's what it is. Well acted, but phew, wow, yikes.
How did you watch it, Steve? That's the big question. We did black and white.
I watched it in color because Nick Cage said it was filmed in color to with these filters and everything to make everything look like surreal color-wise, and that the black and white was literally just a filter over what was already shot afterwards. So if it's not going to be shot in black and white, I'm not going to watch it in black and white, was my mindset.
Oh, that makes sense. I only found out like halfway through while I was watching, and I'm not going to switch. I'm like, I'm already watching it in black and white, so we're sticking with black and white.
But Nick Cage's ridiculous Bogart voice was just so ridiculous. It was comedic
It
in
was
it.
Jimmy Cagney, remember? Because they tell you why he has the why he talks like Jimmy Cagney in the narrative. So
Yeah,
made
when
me
he's
laugh.
tightening up his lips and he's saying, "Hey, don't, he it was it," if he wants to say it was Cagney, that's fine, but it was Bogart. And it was ridiculous. But and there's a noir version of Electro and Tombstone and Sandman, but overall it's not really very Spider-Man-y, the thing. The actress who plays his secretary was great, and even though it was not the best depiction of the Silvermane character, the heavy Irish accented old guy who played Silvermane really did the part well and was a fine actor. So the acting was good. It was just the material.
I had fun with because it was so over the top. My big beef was it wasn't really noir, so it was just set in an era, but and with some of the tropes, but missing for me some of the key parts of noir. So for that part, it's not double. Like from a quality, it's not Double Indemnity, but missing some of those key elements of. Like the betrayal was so weak, and the femme fatale's not much of a femme. They're just missing for me the real. And I get they didn't want to hammer those because those are bleak. I mean, I'm no expert in it, but the ones I've watched, while I enjoy them, they are very bleak. Like there's no happy endings in any of the ones I've ever seen. I think it was more like a Philip Marlowe type of gumshoe. The detective Dashiell Hammett type of thing rather than the dark noir. But curious if they do another one. It was just Nicolas Cage always is just something to watch. It makes me laugh. What can I say? They gave a story reason though why he talks and acts so ridiculous. So that helped a little bit for me anyways. That I bought that. Like it's part of the premise involves, and it was almost as I would say it leans more almost to like 1930s horror in a way, like monstrous people that now seems kind of funny in a way, those sort of things where the people aren't people, they're mons. Almost the think high evolutionary might be a better way to think this thing through with the things. But, I also, watching at home and all that, I wouldn't have wanted to go pay and sit in a theater type of thing. I grade everything better if I'm at home, or if I go out to a theater, I'm expecting more.
The other big news is the big change in Marvel publishing. The bullpen, it's gone. Where'd it go? I knocked on the door, nobody was there. Marvel Comics has moved out of New York, along with every other business that's got interests elsewhere. It's the end of an era. It's all Hollywood now. Marvel's moving to California, and it could be bad, but the new editor-in-chief is at least an interesting choice. He's an outsider, but he's someone who is a known quantity who once was part of the fold. In Steve Wacker. So, it's what do you think?
Speaking of big time and Brand New Day and 52 and all that stuff.
So he was the editor at that time of the Spider-Man book, right?
Yeah, he was keeping the trains running on time and all that. And, you know, people seemed to like him. And it's funny that he left Marvel to, like, edit some Hickman books. So, I mean, I don't have any really bad things to say. I mean, it was just surprising that it took so long for where Marvel was heading. And you're like, well, all these other guys are leaving. Like, you got rid of David Gabriel and everyone, but I'm like, CB was still there. So I'm like, when's CB leaving? And we found out.
I mean, obviously I don't work there, so don't have the inside track, but I think these things really stink. I mean, I'm the biggest fan of the Southern California you're going to find, but to really put the squeeze, like, if you have kids in school or maybe your spouse has a job, or now they're forcing everybody to be like, hey, you know, now you're moving. I didn't like it when DC did it. Disney also did this to a bunch of their people when they were going to consolidate everything into Florida and said, you know, move or lose your job. And I don't like it. I think it's an excuse to get rid of people. And as I said, I'm the biggest, you know, LA's in the name, LA Rabbit. So you're not going to find anybody that isn't more pro the town. But I don't know. It just really always chaps my hide when they do these forcing people, you know, oh, move, you know, your whole life gets disrupted and it's just not very nice.
Rereading. Yeah, the DC one, it seemed like it was happening over 1 month and they had to come up with a publishing plan or story to fill that month. And the Marvel one, I guess, is happening over 12 months. So I guess there won't be that much of a disruption.
I mean, from a customer standpoint, I do think they needed to make a change. Yeah. I've been so, and look, I'm only one guy with particularly weird tastes. So not the, as Kevin says, don't make all your comics for me. But
I always say that. That was the number one thing I would say whenever they would come out with, I know, like, people specifically want comics for them. And, you know, there's a certain segment of audience that complains about how this other stuff is doing well. Where's my stuff? But really, I'm always like, don't make comics for me.
But my Marvel pull list is at its lowest. It's been in a while. I'm getting all the fringe, like the 2099, which I think is now on hiatus, the space stuff, you know, the Eternal Guardians and a few things. But I'm really, it's just, you know, get me. I was dumb enough. Remember all those times I buy all the tie-ins and everything? Like, that idiot still exists. So, you know, it behooves them to get to kind of do something to shake this thing up and not just fire a bunch of people like they did a few months ago who are behind the scenes, but, you know, decide they're going to figure out what direction to go. And look, it's not, maybe not fair to the top guy, but that's the job. And I'm sure he was well compensated and he can always go back and pretend to be a Japanese guy again or whatever. So,
yeah, funny you should notice that his new job is to go to Asia and, you know, facilitate some of that stuff over there. So,
and they don't mind that. That doesn't chap their hide.
You know, that's closer to what his job was before. Yes. EIC anyways.
That's,
and it
true.
Seemed like he was better at that stuff. At least from the outside, it looked like, oh, he was bringing in all these different, you know, he's doing the manga thing, bringing in different artists. We're like, cool. So when he became that position, we're like, oh, he brought these people in. Maybe he'll be good as a editor-in-chief.
Exactly.
And then it became what it became.
Yep. And the other
thing is, I don't know, maybe he'll do better in his new old position.
After looking at a whole bunch of Spider-Man comics and trying to flip through and see what caught my eye worth enough to recommend here, it's funny to have that paired with this news of Marvel leaving New York, because, like, Spider-Man is New York. You know, reading these Spider-Man comics, New York is one of the supporting characters in Spider-Man comics and is a big part of it. What's going on in New York? And we didn't even mention, you didn't mention among your Black issues, Andrew, the Black cover issue that was related to 9/11, the Spider-Man tribute issue. I mean, Spider-Man
9/11 comics were not my cup of tea, but
Spider-Man, but that was the only one that was a part of the actual series, not a special fundraising comic or anything like that. That was a regular issue because something happened to New York.
It's like New York
happened to Aunt May. You need, you know, Spidey's got to react. So it's a big part of all Marvel comics, not just Spider-Man. So it'll be interesting to see over the years how things change, because they're going to change. Are they going to become more like the movies? Are they going to become more spread through the country and have, I mean, I guess creators still live where they live, but are they going to be as tasked by the editors to write stories in New York? I don't know.
I mean, I feel like there's been eras where they've been spread across the country and everything,
And how did that go?
I mean, there was great stories.
The Great Lakes Avengers, when Daredevil went to San Francisco for a while there. I don't know.
The Runaways were in L.A. I mean, that was good. Thor was in, what was it, Oklahoma or whatever. That was fine.
It was funny when Peter went on tour. Remember when he had his book of Spider-Man photos and he was
promoting it?
I was like, they should release that as a real book somewhere. Right. Just have the like cover drawn. I don't know. They could have fun with it. But I always thought it was, I don't remember, was it called Webs or something? But it's funny. Peter Parker did a big press tour for his collected photos as a book. Yeah, just the development of the character led to some fun thing. Like, that's something you would do if you were a photographer for a long time. You know, you'd put out a book.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Is New York going to still be part of the Marvel brand? Right? Because it is.
I can't see it. You'd have to, like, all of a sudden all the heroes are like, oh, I'm leaving New York and I'm never coming back. And
that doesn't mean they have to leave New York, but will it still be as authentic with the company not being there? We'll see.
The creators aren't there anyways. It's like international creators. You can live wherever you want. That's
doing what the editors say.
In an era where you can live wherever you want, companies are still moving somewhere.
Who's hiring that creators?
People are having to move with them rather than you can just live anywhere. Like, or people are like, oh, you can just do it online. You don't need to meet in person. And still, the need is still there for people to meet in person, even though you don't have to.
When the editor meets with when the editor from LA, who was born in LA and lives in LA because that's where his family is, and the other guy wasn't going to leave New York and leave his family, or maybe he didn't even have the option to. When he hires talent and explains to them what he wants out of them, is he going to have that an authentic New York state of mind, so to speak? I can't see it being the same. So it'll be curious to see how it filters through.
You're going to have to, you'd have to restructure the universe, I think.
My more concern would be that they just shrink the number of roles and the Marvel comics becomes a lot smaller, because they're just like, oh, hey, you know, now our focus is the movies and TV. Now that we're all under the same tent.
As long as it's the top end, they shrink, you know,
they can let the creators away. Create. I agree, but I mean, I don't want to see them pare away. It's nice. Again, to show my love for Across the Street, I feel like good editors had make. I mean, for me, they can try and revive Vertigo all they want, but until they get a Karen Berger over there, I don't see it being the same thing. Like, the editors really, you need those people. Like, they provide, it's not just something they can put it off. And I'm hoping they don't just trim it so bad they don't get that. I think that, look, I'm not saying the editors deserve creditor rights or anything, but I do think they've added and can curate and help really deliver sometimes. And I hope that they don't squeeze it to be like, well, we can save a dime by firing all the editors and have ChatGPT edit the books or whatever.
Roy Thomas created Wolverine.
Oh, brother.
That's what I was trying to avoid, Steve. I was trying to not wade into that mess, but yeah, that's the type of thing.
I was going to say something controversial, like on Indie, where I say something I wasn't really into Berger books, but, you know, that's me being the being the big Marvel head and not being into indie books at all and everything. So, you know.
Well, that's the thing, though. Even though you may not like it, the point was she was curating for a certain audience.
Oh, yeah.
You just
sure.
weren't that. But it gave the books sort of, it was a way for some of us to transition from straight superhero to other interesting things, much like Epic was the same. I always felt that was a kind of a gateway drug as well to sort of experience different sort of things if you were still getting your books a certain way, because, you know, that led me to Martial Law and all these other wonderful ideas. So I think that those kind of experiments that can only be done when the company puts resources behind it are worthwhile. But we'll see. I mean, maybe I'm just being overly cynical about it. I just don't like when they combine jobs. I feel like it's an excuse to get rid of people, and the last layoffs seem like people that have been there a long time. Yeah. And I don't really love that. I mean, people put a lot of work into the companies, and it's a way, you know, we'll just replace them with someone new and cheap or whatever. But I don't know. I'm always going to be on the side of labor, unfortunately.
Just replace the X-Men with the Inhumans. Nobody will know.
Exactly.
We got this. This will be seamless. No problem.
You know, we'll just replace them with somewhere cheap because, you know, that's how we're going to defeat manga.
Yeah, right. Let's go cheap.
I hear that's going to work.
All right.
I mean, I don't think they can go much cheaper on the paper they use. So.
You're still reading paper? All right. We're going
paper
on.
Paper forever.
We're pushing 90 minutes here, so we should wrap this episode up. Let's make that another episode of Marvel Noise. We got heavy into the Spider-Man's world this episode and chatted up some news and notes. And next time, well, who knows? Anything's possible here on Marvel Noise, as long as it's Marvel-related. Right, Andrew?
And, you know, we can talk about whenever we like. We own the show. We control the vertical and the horizontal, Steve.
Yo. It's following me. The show's following me. The call's coming from inside the house. Any last words, Kevin? Any final chapter?
this is a brand new day, is what it is.
The Steve Wackerverse. It's going to be across the top of every Marvel comic. Just you wait and see. Better than now connected to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Anything's
until
possible.
Until CB is in control of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, make mine Marvel.
Promoted. I remember all the they used to have all those banners like now a Saturday morning cartoon.
right, for sure. All right, gang. Thanks for listening.
I think the second season of that Spider-Man cartoon is supposed to come on eventually. They made some choices.
More Spider-Man is usually good Spider-Man. We hope. Later.